But since you ask about transplant now, we might as well talk a little bit about transplants. If a person gets a transplanted organ, what does their body do? What is now, when we say it rejects it, what does that mean? Okay, so the immune system is going to attack that organ. Now, what kind of hypersensitivity reaction would that be considered? Say again? Type 4. Type 4 is cell mediated, which means what kind of cells? T cells. All right, so the T cells are going to direct macrophages to attack that organ. So just for the sake of argument, let's say that it's someone who's got a liver transplant. So the person with the liver transplant, in order to prevent their body from rejecting that organ, is going to be put on what kind of medications? Immunosuppressants. Now, how do we know that a patient is having transplant rejection? What's the first sign or symptom that they'll have? Fever. All right, so if you ever have a question that asks you, you've got a patient who's got a transplant, and we think there might be rejection, what would be the very first sign that you would want to think of? Fever. So it's not going to necessarily be so simple as we're going to say, your patient has a transplant and now has a fever. We'll say, well, your patient's two days post-op for getting a new liver, and here's blah, blah, and they have all those vital signs. You'll say, what's going on with them? And the first thing you should think, with, if you see a temperature that's high, you're going to think? Fever, rejection. All right. Now, there's three basic things that we're going to do to immunosuppress this person. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to put them on a calcineurin inhibitor. What are the two calcineurin inhibitors that we said you should know? Cyclosporin and tacrolimus. For our purposes, they're basically the same. Cyclosporin has a little bit more kidney toxicity. Tacrolimus works a little better, but it's a little newer, a little bit more expensive. Other than that, you can think of them as basically the same thing because they do exactly the same thing. So the first thing we want to do is put them on a calcineurin inhibitor. Then usually the patient will also be on a cytotoxic drug. What do cytotoxic drugs do? They kill rapidly proliferating cells. And for transplant rejection, immunosuppression, the drug that's usually going to be used is azathioprine. And then the last drug that a person will be on is a high-dose steroid, at least at first. So now, the moment the person gets out of surgery, and maybe even before they go into surgery, they're going to be put on at least the calcineurin inhibitor. Now, let's imagine that our patient is on a normal dose of their calcineurin inhibitor, the azathioprine, and a steroid. What steroid would they probably be on in the hospital? Prednisone by mouth, and if it's an injection, methylprednisolone. So let's imagine for a moment they're on 60 milligrams of methylprednisolone daily. Now, patient gets a fever 2 days after they've gotten out of surgery. Which of those three drugs do you think we're going to increase? We have three choices. We have calcineurin inhibitor, the azathioprine, or we have the methylprednisolone. Which one is going to be increased? Now, what did we say the immunosuppressive dose of methylprednisolone was? 500 to 1,500. So if we've got a patient who's only on 60 milligrams and they start getting a fever because we're going to think transplant rejection, that's the drug that's going to be increased. And typically what will happen is that patient will get 1,000 milligrams of methylprednisolone for 2 to 3 days. To kind of stop the transplant rejection, and then they'll try and titrate the other two drugs and then bring the methylprednisolone back down. Now, why don't we want to keep the patient on a high-dose methylprednisolone the whole time? Say again? Okay, well, all immunosuppression is going to make a person more susceptible to infection, but why do we really want to limit the dose of the methylprednisolone? You can go ahead and look at those adverse effects. Say again? All right, it's not so much because of the adrenal suppression, because the patient's going to probably be on prednisone or methylprednisolone for the rest of their life. So it's because of the osteoporosis, the impaired wound healing, the muscle wasting, the fat redistribution. You know, all of those things together are going to make it so that you really don't want this patient to be on high doses of those drugs. Now, what do we say a patient can do to try and counteract those adverse effects? Exercise. Now, the exercise is only going to work up to a point. There's a point where if the dose is high enough for long enough, no matter how much the person exercises, the drugs are going to still have their adverse effects. So what you want to try and do is keep the patient on as low a dose as possible, because you're going to have fewer side effects and the patient will have a better chance of counteracting those side effects with exercise. So, our transplant patient, what are the three drugs that they're going to be on? A calcineurin inhibitor, what are the two possibilities? Cyclosporine and tacrolimus. What's the second drug class? Cytotoxic. What's the drug? Azathioprine. What's the third class? Steroid. And the two most likely drugs are going to be prednisone or methylprednisolone. All right. Any questions about that? Now, when we get to next semester, we'll talk about some other drugs that the patients will be on. Because of their immunosuppression, they're now at risk for infection. So what we're going to do is we're going to give them drugs that will help prevent infections. And those are really just antibiotics of different kinds. So we'll talk about those next semester. Anyone else have any other questions? Let's talk about pain. All right, so we introduced opioid drugs. And we're going to actually talk about several different opioid drugs now. The two major classes of opioid agonists, we classify them according to their strength. We have strong and we have moderate. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about morphine in a lot of detail, because if you understand morphine, there's only a few little tweaks to the other drugs, and then you'll understand them as well. So morphine affects central and peripheral opioid receptors. The major effects: analgesia, meaning reducing pain, drowsiness, mental clouding, kind of a fogginess, reduction in anxiety, and euphoria. I feel good. Now, some other effects. These are things that we don't necessarily want euphoria, we don't necessarily want mental clouding, but sometimes they're used therapeutically. If you want to give a patient an opioid drug, in addition to a drug like Versed, which is kind of like Valium, you give the two drugs together, it makes the person kind of happy and kind of forgetful, and they don't remember what happened to them. So you can use that in some minor surgical procedures like colonoscopies in place of doing full anesthesia. So even the mental clouding does have therapeutic uses, but generally speaking, that's not going to be something we really want the patient to have. Why is that? Why don't we want our patient to be mentally cloudy? I mean, just in general. Why would it be bad for a person to be mentally cloudy? Okay, like doing what? Like driving? Using the sewing machine? I just sewed my finger. Yeah. So mental clouding is bad because it allows accidents to happen. People fall down more. They crash their cars. And I'm sorry, officer. By the way, you can get a DUI in Florida for substances other than alcohol in the blood. So again, mental clouding, the major reason is because it can cause accidents. It can cause the patient to do things they wouldn't ordinarily do and have bad consequences. All right, some other effects. We have respiratory depression, slowing down of the breathing rate. Constipation, slowing down of the GI tract. Urinary retention, slowing down of the urinary tract. In this case, we're talking about the bladder relaxation. Orthostatic hypotension. Now, what is orthostatic hypotension again? It's when you stand up and the blood pressure doesn't compensate. So we have a 10 millimeter drop in blood pressure. Now, what did we say earlier that the two causes of orthostatic hypotension were? Dehydration and drugs. What drugs did we talk about earlier that caused orthostatic hypotension? What drug would that be? What drug class? Would you like me to give you a drug name and see if you can name the class? Terazosin. Would you like another drug name? Phentolamine. This class is like one big review session. Say it again, please.
Alpha-1 blockers.
So, alpha-1 blocking causes what to happen in the body? Well, that's the side effect, but how does it work? Vasodilation. All right, so vasodilation of the arteries can cause orthostatic hypotension. It'll cause lower blood pressure, yes, but the side effect would be the orthostatic hypotension. Now, the way morphine causes orthostatic hypotension is by causing venous dilation. So what I want you to do is look down at your hands. Now, hang your hands down by your side for a minute. Okay, now, after you've had them down there for a bit, look at them. What do you see down there? Veins! Ooh! Now, those. Why do you see the veins? Now, hold your hand up top. What happens to those veins? They disappeared. Okay, so why do your veins swell up when you hang your arm down and then disappear when you raise your hand up? Okay, gravity. Gravity's pulling that blood downwards into the veins. Now, if your body really needed the blood in your hand, what would it do to those veins? Okay, your veins can also squeeze. They can also constrict. And what morphine does is it prevents venous vasoconstriction. So it actually makes your veins relax. So there's more blood in the veins. Now, if there's more blood in the veins, where is there less blood? In the arteries. So what were the two reasons that caused orthostatic hypotension? Dehydration and drugs. Now, venous dilation, what it really is kind of like causing a very transient lack of volume in the arteries, because you're shunting the volume from the arteries to the veins. Now, this is unique to morphine. The others don't necessarily do this one. Morphine can also cause emesis and nausea. What is emesis? Vomiting. So, you come in because you broke your leg and you're in incredible pain, and now we give you some morphine, and then you feel nauseated and you feel like you have to throw up. Not everyone gets it. It is also dose-related, so the more dose we give, the more the chances of feeling nauseated and emesis. Meiosis. What do we say meiosis was? The opposite. Yeah, pupil constriction. So one of the classic signs that a person was doing heroin in the 70s and 80s was if you looked them in the eyes, they had very tiny little pupils. They call them pinpoint pupils because they're so constricted that barely had pupils at all. Now, is that kind of person going to be able to see very well? So what do they need? What can you as a nurse do? Now, I heard glasses. So what kind of glasses? Eyeglasses or sunglasses? Well, okay, do they have a problem focusing? No, they don't have a problem focusing. They have a problem with constriction. What is the purpose of dilating pupils in the first place? To let more light in. So what does that person need? They need bright light, bright light. For those of you Gremlin fans. So what they need is for you as the nurse to make sure they have a nice, well-lit room. Because they're more likely to trip and fall because they can't see things in a dark room. So patients who are on opioid drugs need more light because of the meiosis. Next one we have is cough suppression. Now, is cough suppression a good thing? Now, does coughing serve a purpose? What purpose? Okay. So, get stuff out of your lungs. But is there ever a time when you just want to stop coughing? Just please, just let me get 2 hours of sleep without coughing and I'll be thankful forever. Okay, so we can use opioid drugs to suppress coughing. Now, how many of you have ever taken Robitussin AC? Not DM, but AC, the stuff you have to get a prescription for. Yeah, Robitussin with codeine. Basically, it's a syrup with codeine in it. How many of you ever saw the movie Tombstone? Yeah, Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday? No? All right. Well, Wyatt Earp's wife had several problems, and coughing was one of them. So she got addicted to codeine, you know, in her cough syrup. But anyway, that's enough. So we can use opioid drugs to suppress cough. But if you have a patient who really needs to cough, like say a pneumonia patient, or a patient who's got bronchitis and has got copious amounts of sputum. Copious, such a wonderful word. What does that mean? Large amounts, just lots of it. So if they have copious amounts of sputum, you might not want to give them an opioid because it could suppress their cough reflex so much that they begin to literally drown in their own sputum. Next one is biliary colic. Now, what is a colic? Kind of a painful spasm. And what do we mean by biliary? What word is in there, biliary? Bile. Now, what produces bile? Not the bile duct. That's a good guess. The liver. Now, the liver is going to secrete that bile through the biliary tree, which is like a little network of small little canals that are going to eventually turn into the bile duct. And then it's going to get stored in the gallbladder or the cholecyst. And then when you eat a meal, that gallbladder is going to squeeze and release some bile into your gut. But the biliary tree is what we're talking about here. So coming from your liver and going toward the gallbladder. Morphine can cause that biliary tree to spasm up, and it's incredibly painful. And then we have venous pooling, which goes back to causing the orthostatic hypotension.